Hello.
Hello.
I'm Max.
I'm Tess. Davey.
Welcome to the 14th episode of the ADHD Science Podcast. Uh-huh. How are you, Tess?
Oh God, so many questions. I'm okay.
It's not an unusual one for me to ask.
You still caught me off guard.
I did.
My A-levels are very soon, so I'm a bit stressed about that, but yeah, I'm going to live.
Everyone crossed their fingers for Tess to get brilliant grades.
Yes. One like of this podcast equals one prayer for my A-levels.
Yeah, that's a good one. A five-star review is five prayers for your A-levels.
Five prayers for the price of one interaction.
Exactly right.
We're doing some great deals on this podcast today.
Today, we are going to revert to our normal format of an interview today with Giorgia Michelini. Giorgia is a lecturer at Queen Mary's University, also does some work with King's College London, and is basically really interesting about all sorts of things, but today mainly talking about the usefulness of EEG in helping with diagnosis of ADHD. Very kind of really good chat, actually, basically someone who knows an awful lot about all sorts of different aspects of ADHD.
And if you're thinking, what's an EEG, don't worry, we will get into that.
We'll get into all of that. So without further ado, we will get you into the episode. Not too many more before we take a summer break while Tess does her A-levels.
Yep.
And then we will just have to see how everyone feels when those are done.
Yeah.
All right. But anyway, for now, enjoy the episode.
Enjoy.
Okay, hello, welcome. So we are joined today by Giorgia Michelini. Is that how I pronounce that correctly?
Michelini, but that's
Michelini.
Fine.
Oh, there we go. 50-50. Lecturer and researcher in psychology at Queen Mary's University of London. And we're going to talk about, EEG and treatment and all those sorts of things. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I was looking forward to it.
So I picked up a paper of yours, which I'm going to read out the title, and I think
very
probably the first part of this podcast is going to be explaining what your title means, and then I think people will go, oh, okay. So just hang with us, listeners, because it's going to start off a little bit rocky, and then we'll get to why this actually matters and why this actually really kind of made my ears prick up, and some of your other work as well. So it's electrophysiological and clinical predictors of methylphenidate, guanfacine, and combined treatment outcomes in children with ADHD. So let's unpack the first part unpacking that. So Tess, take away number question one.
So in your research, what question were you answering?
So it is true, first of all, that the title is a bit of a mouthful, and it's partly because it's in a psychiatric journal, so it's a little bit, it should hopefully be clearer for clinicians, but maybe it's a little bit less clear for everyone. So the study here did investigate measures that could be useful for predicting whether a child with ADHD will be likely or not to respond to certain medication treatment. So in terms of types of predictors, we investigated electrophysiological markers, so measures that would come from an EEG recording. I'm sure we can talk a little bit more about that as well as clinical predictors. So that would be measures that could be routinely collected by a pediatrician, a psychiatrist, things like severity of ADHD or whether there are other mental health symptoms in the person, things like that. So they are a little bit more readily available than the EEG recordings. With the EEG, it's essentially some electrodes placed on someone's scalp that are meant to record their brain activity in real time. So it is often used while people are doing absolutely nothing, so it's called at rest, or it can be used while people are completing a task during either in the real world or on a computer. So in this case, for the study, we had children with ADHD complete a working memory task with this EEG recording their brain activity. And they did this EEG recording before they were put on three types of medication treatment for ADHD. One was methylphenidate. So it's the first line treatment for ADHD. It's a stimulant medication. The second one was guanfacine, which is a non-stimulant option. So it is usually one of those considered when stimulants don't work. So if somebody doesn't respond to stimulant or doesn't tolerate them well, they might try guanfacine or other non-stimulant medication. And then the third type of treatment was their combination. So essentially, people were taking both methylphenidate and guanfacine together. And it was with the idea that their combined effect could create greater benefit in a way. Now, the background of this was that there had been other studies in the same sample that have found greater effect of the combined treatment on ADHD symptoms and functioning relative to methylphenidate only or guanfacine only treatment. So what we wanted to understand here was whether we could use some of these EEG measures as well as these more readily available clinical measures to understand why some people were responding better to these three types of treatment, essentially. Yeah. Does this clarify a little bit what the title is and what we set out to do?
I mean, when you say, just for the audience really, but when you say stimulant medication, non-stimulant medication, how would you describe the difference there?
That's a great question.
It's essentially a difference in how these different medications work. So stimulant medications work essentially trying to increase the level of dopamine and norepinephrine in the brain. So these are two chemicals that are strongly involved in things that underlie ADHD, like attention, impulsivity, ability to control movement, and things like that. So by increasing and stimulating the level of these chemicals in the brain, then these the stimulant medication seem to have an effect on ADHD symptoms. Non-stimulants are another class of medications that don't work on stimulating, but rather they sort of have an opposite action. So guanfacine, as an example, is an agonist of another type of receptor within the brain, and so it has a slightly different way of functioning, and that's why it's a sort of an alternative option. When the stimulant option doesn't seem to work, then there might be the possibility that the non-stimulant type of mechanism would then be useful for people with ADHD. And then their combination sometimes would then be even more beneficial, because you might need a bit of both of these two mechanisms of action to then have some clinical benefits.
Yeah, it's a very interesting distinction between the two. And in a sense, stimulants are more of an immediate hit. They kind of change the here and now of your brain chemistry. And they, once they wear off, they've broadly gone. Whereas the non-stimulants, by conventional clinical wisdom, and it certainly had been my experience, they take a while to kind of build up.
They're much slower. It's interesting how you can see the stimulant effect within a few hours and then it wears out by the end of the day, whereas with this non-stimulants they may need be weeks to
make it. It's almost like it changes the way that your brain responds to things, rather than just being in the moment.
So does a non-stimulant have a longer lasting effect?
Max knows better than me about this.
It's obviously over.
No, go ahead.
It's essentially the stimulant as a non-stimulant as well, they need to be taken continuously. So there are actually studies that show that discontinuing stimulant medication can have negative effects, because they're not medications that would, you can take for a few months and then they will give you long-lasting benefit. They need to be taken on a daily basis. And then sometimes with the stimulant effect, the good and bad thing of their very fast action is that people sometimes decide to take sort of meds holidays, they say, or they will maybe not take them at the weekend because it's not you know, they don't need to sit still the whole day during the week, and they, you know, they can just, you know, have, be full of energy and be there 100% through self. Or during summer holidays, they might have a break from medication, but then when it is needed to, say, sit still at school or during work, be focused all the time, then that's where the medication can help some people.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, sometimes more seriously, you know, if the medication is affecting someone's appetite, so some of the younger children I look after, where they're not really gaining weight during the, because they're not really having enough calories, then you can take them on, you can take them off the medication over the weekend. They basically eat all weekend.
Yeah, you just say catch up. And another effect, one of the side effects that is known, is on height. So some people actually, you know, there are studies that show that the people that are, the children that are on stimulant medication, then don't grow as tall as they should. Yeah. So that can also have a...
It's a small effect, but it's certainly definitely
Do you think that's connected to the lack of nutrients from the lower diet? I mean, the lower appetite, sorry.
I don't really know. Maybe Georgia knows, but I don't think it's just the lower nutrients. I think there may be a more direct effect on growth hormone.
Yeah, I actually don't know much about this. It's just one of those things where, you know, it is, there are, you know, treatments that need to be taken continuously. Yeah. So they will have their side effects, and that's why it's totally fair for some people to not want, or families, parents not to be keen on their children to take them continuously.
But to go back to your question, Tess, yes, broadly speaking, if you're on a non-stimulant and once you've got past that first few weeks of getting it off the ground, I would say that also needs to be taken every day. Otherwise, the overall effect is going to start to tail off.
Yeah.
But if you miss one dose, it doesn't really greatly matter. But you do get a continuous effect from it because it's built up over those few weeks.
Right.
Do you see what I mean? There is also, it appears, an immediate effect from where you give the dose. So it doesn't matter when you give the dose during the day for non-stimulants. And sometimes that can be helpful if you've got sleep difficulties or something else like that.
Yeah.
But there's also this background hum of effect. I almost think of it as like a background hum of just generally calming things down. And that is a 24-hour phenomenon for the non-stimulants. Mm. So if they do work, and they don't always work, which is one problem, they can be really, really helpful, super helpful.
So how does this link to all of the, what was it, the EEGs? And the
so that's the next question.
And I guess that's, you know, like the point that Max just raised, is that they don't always work. So, and figuring out whether stimulant work or maybe non-stimulant would be better, or maybe you need both, it's a trial and error process that can take weeks or months, right? So a child, you know, a seven-year-old child that is put on stimulant first, they might try stimulants for a few weeks, then they go back to their psychiatrist or pediatrician and it didn't really work very well. So let's maybe try this other thing. Maybe that doesn't work either. And a non-stimulant, you need to actually wait for a bit longer to see whether it works or not. So, you know, months have passed and maybe let's try both of them together. And maybe let's try something else, you know, more physical activity, or let's do some behavioral intervention. All this can take months or years sometimes, which in the time span of a child can make a huge difference. It could be a whole school year wasted or, you know, with very significant difficulties. And all this time that, you know, could really be saved and difficulties and struggles. So the whole idea of trying to identify measures that we can call biomarkers, for example, that would be able to predict response to these treatments, is that if we, that could really save a lot of time at the outset of somebody, you know, somebody receives a diagnosis of ADHD, and then there is a test that can tell them with some certainty that they will most likely benefit for treatment A and not from treatment B. And then they're put on treatment A, they start showing effects within a few days or weeks, and then this trickles down to, you know, them having better quality of life, not having difficulties at school, things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So our question two.
Question two, what did you find?
So the study here was an 8-week trial. So by looking, we looked at these EEG markers alongside with these clinical markers, and we essentially found some patterns of EEG activity measured from front to center regions of the brain. So we call it mid-frontal EEG activity, essentially from this kind of area. And, you know, when people are not on video will not see it, but the sort of the center of our brain, frontal regions. EEG measures from that area essentially was able to predict the amount of improvement in ADHD symptoms from pre to post treatment. So in the clinical trial associated to this, all three studies, all three medications showed a degree of improvement. And so we wanted to figure out whether some EEG measures and clinical measures were able to tell us, like predict this improvement essentially. And what we found was that, as I said, this mid-frontal EEG activity predicted symptom improvement in ADHD in response to these three treatments, but showing sort of like a different patterns depending on the medication that they were put on. So, this essentially means that different profiles of brain activity may benefit from different types of treatment. So if you have sort of like EEG pattern one, you might be more likely to benefit from one type of treatment. If you have another EEG pattern, you might be more likely to benefit from another type of treatment. So this creates a sort of like a dissociation in the sense that it's then possible to kind of identify these individuals from our analysis that did show these EEG profile based on their midfrontal brain activity, and then see that they were more or less likely to respond to the medication that they were put on.
Which is amazing. Because it, like you say, it saves time, money, and inconvenience, and could lead potentially to better treatment. I'm kind of moved to ask, of course, I must ask, how strong is the predictive power of having? And we're not. I don't think you're right not to go into alpha, delta waves and big.
Yeah, it's a mouthful.
Unnecessary Greekness. Yes. Nothing wrong with being Greekness.
No Greekness is unnecessary.
But you know what I mean. It's unnecessary Greek alphabet. How strong are the correlations? How strong a predictor would be EEG pattern one for? Oh, methylphenidate is going to work for you. Therefore,
yeah, they are not huge effects. So the important thing to discuss is that these sort of EEG markers are not meant to be considered on their own. And that's actually something that we did also demonstrate in another analysis shown in the same paper, where essentially we looked at what happened if we were combining this EEG predictor with the clinical predictors.
Yes.
Okay? So the idea of this is that it would be most unlikely that you just want to predict the treatment outcome by recording their EEG activity. Yeah. You have all this other information as well. So what if we throw them all in the mix to try and predict the treatment outcome?
Because you would never just do it on an EEG.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you would always ask the parents about the symptoms, the child about the symptoms, how they're doing in school and so on. So you have all this other information. How can we use it? And what we found was that the clinical measures on their own had the smallest predictive ability. So they were really not good at telling whether that child would be improving or not with the medication.
So that's very disappointing for me.
Yeah, but that's quite...
I mean, it's not unexpected in a way. It's like, it's incredibly powerful. Why on earth have you not been predicting this all along? Yeah. Good. Okay, fine.
Yeah. The EEG measures on their own, they were doing slightly better, but still not to a greater great extent. But the combination of the two types of information was what was actually giving us a little bit more accuracy. So we found that basically aggregating these clinical and EEG measures predicted the future improvement in ADHD symptoms twice as accurately than using the clinical measures on their own.
Okay, so that's, I mean, twice as accurately as not accurate is still not, it doesn't necessarily tell us it's brilliant.
Yeah,
it's better.
Yeah, it's better. What are the clinic? Do you want?
Oh no. Okay. So let me know if I've misunderstood how EEGs work completely. But don't you get like a bunch of different wave patterns, and you can look for specific wave patterns to find which? How did you know what you were looking for?
So the analysis, the sort of like processing of the signal from EEG can be quite different based on different conditions that you want to look at. So it is okay. One of the most common and well-known use of EEG is for epilepsy, for example. So with epilepsy, you get the recording, you just like all these wiggly lines, one per each of the electrodes that you have on the person's head. And then just from that, with your naked eye, you're able to identify that some bits of it look a bit odd. And that's where there is a sort of an epileptic seizure. And then that's quite a more straightforward type of analysis. When we want to identify EEG markers associated with ADHD or depression or some other behavioral outcome, we need to do a lot more digging. And that means like lots of analysis offline of these signals, trying to quantify whether that signal is oscillating in a slow way or in a faster way. And so the quantifying how much of these kind of faster waves and how much of these faster slower waves there are is one of the ways that we can use to get these types of EEG patterns that are used for in mental health research and for neurodevelopmental disorders like ADHD.
Yeah, so there's not a specific pattern of waves that you're looking for. So it's not like it goes up a lot.
Yeah, no, it's
a little bit and then up a bit and then, you know.
It's not like a signature. Yeah.
No. Yeah, it's a little bit more difficult to identify. Yeah. It's a lot of computer power.
Yes, I can imagine.
Looking at correlations and patterns in that way. I'm curious, what were the clinical, I know that they're not that powerful on their own, but what were the clinical markers that were significant in predicting treatment?
So the most significant ones were ADHD symptoms, the severity of ADHD symptoms, and then also levels of oppositionality and anxiety.
Interesting. So just to spell that out, mm-hmm. The more severe the symptoms, the more likely they are to respond? Or
I think so. It kind of depends on the measure. So of the clinical measures that were predictive of improvements after treatment, we found that greater levels of hyperactivity, impulsivity, as well as oppositional behavior before the treatment were both predictive of greater improvement. So basically a child that shows greater hyperactivity, impulsivity and more oppositionality was then more likely to respond to these treatments. And then the other finding was a lower anxiety. So the children that were less anxious were likely to benefit from the treatments more.
That's so interesting. You may not have looked into this, but one of the things that I find clinically is children who are more anxious before treatment are less likely to tolerate stimulant.
Could well be, yes. So they might be that they are responding less also because, you know, they are
they just can't cope with it.
When they can't cope with it, how does that manifest? What do you mean by that?
Well, in a way, I have this very simplistic way of explaining stimulant medication, which actually kind of matches with how I experience them. And I have taken them myself, that they're like a cup of coffee that lasts all day. And like a cup of coffee stimulates you. And if you have too much espresso, you've never done it, obviously, Tess. You've never overindulged in caffeine, obviously.
Honestly, any caffeine for me is too much, especially when I'm already on my medication, which I guess makes sense with this analogy.
Literally having a cup of tea.
It's a cup of tea. It's very different to
milk. With milk, so I suppose, yeah. Anyway, so a large amount of caffeine will give you the physical sensations of anxiety without the cognitive component of anxiety. Yeah. So you won't be thinking, I'm terrible or I'm going to fail my exam, but you will have the same physical feeling in your body. And actually that's the reason I stopped taking this stimulant medications, because at a dose that was effective enough to actually make a difference to my symptoms, I was having during the middle of the day this kind of physical sense of gnawing anxiety, though I was in myself perfectly fine. I wasn't particularly anxious. But if I also was
anxious in myself, that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, it was unbearable. So I stopped him.
Yeah.
So I suppose I would sort of guess that I hypothesized that that might be contributing, that, that the anxious children pre-treatment are dropping out more because they're just not, they just can't manage it.
Well, they can only manage a really low dose.
Maybe
they could still, you know, be taking the medication as prescribed, but then they will sort of report, you know, a lower reduction in ADHD symptoms that might just be like a non-specific, you know, feeling of not feeling
because
of this anxiety that is induced by the medication. Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense. Another thing that I was is worth mentioning here is that these, you know, ADHD symptoms, oppositionality, anxiety did predict treatment response, but in the same way across treatment. So that means that with these measures alone, you can say, okay, a child that is higher on hyperactivity will most likely respond to any of these three treatments. So then that's not really useful because it doesn't tell you, again, which one is more likely to work. So that's why the sort of like the combination of the clinical measures with the EEG measures then gives us more precision in being able to say this treatment will be better than this other one.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, if in the future we have access to that sort of biomarker at the beginning of treatment, then that would be really fantastic to kind of help us to predict what might, what, you know, what treatment we might be helpful. So I suppose that that kind of leads us on to our third question.
It sure does. Our third question is, as always, what does this mean for people looking after people with ADHD?
It's, I mean, Max put it right that, you know, it is something that in the future could happen. So it's, these are still experimental findings. It's a, you know, it's a trial that was relatively large for being treatment trial of ADHD. We had about 200 children. But still, the findings definitely need to be replicated in a larger sample across different contexts. You know, it was a US sample. It's not been tested in the UK or in other countries. So that's something to look at. And also that across different types of people with ADHD. Of course, the ADHD community is not just one type. Here, it was a study with mostly boys. The ADHD, so we had we didn't really have the ability to tell whether boys or girls would respond, would have like the findings would be similar across the two. So again, what it would be really important to really spread it across, like trying to understand whether these findings would replicate you know, across different ages in samples with a higher number of girls or women as well. And then people with different presentations of ADHD or co-occurring conditions. So like all treatment trials, they are quite selective in who goes in this trial. So they will exclude a bunch of co-occurring conditions. They will look for people with certain characteristics. So it really needs to be replicated in much larger sample, much more diverse communities as well. You know, in the future, if this happened and all was replicated, it's all well and good, then the next step would really be to try and run sort of like more practical, pragmatic trials that will, you know, within, primary care or, you know, specialist care, you know, really test what is the benefit for the patients, for the family, but also in a cost benefit analysis of using this new technology alongside the clinical measures versus just doing what we are doing now. So does this new way of predicting treatment response lead to a better, faster response to medication, better quality of life for the patient and the family? And maybe does it also save money long term? Because you can imagine that if you put somebody on the right medication from the outset, then you don't need to have too many follow-up visits where you continue changing medication and titrating a little bit and increasing, decreasing the dose. So maybe even though you would need this initial cost of the EEG technology and the technician that gives the EEG and somebody that analyzes the data, that of course comes with cost. But maybe there could be a money saved in the long run. And so from a cost-benefit analysis, that might could then end up being beneficial. So all this still remains to be done. And to my knowledge, it hasn't been tested for any of these types of EEG markers. Or in general, it's not something that is really done yet. With all of these measures, kind of predictors of treatment outcomes, we are still very much in the more experimental and discovery phase of trying to identify measures that would be promising to then try to bring them forward for these more clinically relevant considerations.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I totally understand the excitement of this, and I share it. It's something that I get asked about several times a week when we're starting treatment is, you know, how do we, is there a way of telling what's going to work? And it would be lovely to be able to say yes, but we do still need to answer that question. Is it going to save the money that we need, would need it to save in order for it to be cost neutral? I mean, it doesn't have to, I wouldn't say it has to be cost neutral if it also has benefits in terms of better outcomes, you know, less exclusions from school, those sorts of things. But, you know, cost neutrality would be a real help for trying to sell it.
Yeah, within the NHS. You know, climate,
looking but... 5 years in the future to the NHS particularly. But I think also in any kind of health system, cost neutrality is important. I wanted to ask a broader question because I know that you don't just work with EEG and you've recently published a review. I think it's a review. I haven't actually read the whole thing. I just looked at it this morning. I have to be honest. I don't spend my whole time reading ADHD. Oh,
that's fair enough.
And I'm also on holiday. I did look, and you've done a review on treatment biomarkers more broadly. So is it worth doing a little bit at this point, a little bit of a sidestep into what the other biomarkers that you think are promising and where are we at in the field generally?
Yeah, so in the other paper that you are mentioning, we covered, it was a review, that's right, and we covered EEG biomarkers, but also biomarkers from MRI, as well as from genetic markers. So these three are really some of the areas where there is most research essentially identify biomarkers of treatment response. And it kind of like followed a lot of previous research that were focused a little bit more on just cognitive measures. So just measures of, you know, tests of attention or memory on their own without looking at their underlying brain mechanisms. Now, all those cognitive markers didn't really show a lot of benefit over the clinical measures alone. So that's why that area has kind of been abandoned a little bit more. And in recent years, there's been a bit more enthusiasm towards these brain measures, either with EEG or MRI, fMRI. So I have to say, probably our assessment of the literature was that between the EEG and the MRI marker, we thought that the EEG ones might be a little bit more promising.
Okay.
For two reasons. One is because of the type of findings that have come out that seem to be a little bit more convincing. So our study was one of them that seemed to be finding something promising for EEG. There have been some other ones that we also review of different types of measures from the EEG recordings. And then the second reason is also a practical one in terms of costs. So we were just talking about costs. The cost of doing an MRI or an fMRI for somebody is several hundred pounds. An EEG will cost, you know, 25 quid approximately. So it's a lot cheaper. And here we're just talking
cheap, actually.
So much cheaper. So that is, you know, and I'm not considering here the sort of technician time that would be needed to, that would be added to both of these essentially. But the actual, you know, the actual materials or that are needed for doing the EEG, that's a very cheap type of technology compared to MRI. So if we think of the scalability of this, Of course, EEG is a lot more practical. The other aspect is also another practical consideration is that with MRI, it doesn't do very well with people when they're moving.
No.
Yes. You can think somebody with ADHD, you just tell them, you know, just lie there for 1 hour and don't move at all.
You know you're six and you have ADHD, yeah. but do you mind lying there for an hour completely silently and still? Yeah,
yeah, okay, so that doesn't do very well with that sort of what they're called motion artifacts. No. EEG does a little bit better. So it's, it's a little bit, we are able to get around those a little bit better. So that's another consideration.
You get wear a frontal hat, yeah.
Yeah. And then the third type of measures that are maybe even easier to get would be the genetics. So
yeah.
And this is something that has become more, you know, of interest with the, you know, evolution of technology around genomics, essentially. So, again, it used to be a lot more expensive to get someone's DNA and get their essentially, essentially get them genotyped, which means they have a full idea of what their DNA looks like. And now it costs only, you know, £100 or something. So that you just collect someone's saliva, you send it to a lab, and then very cheaply you can get somebody's genome mapped out, essentially. And what people in genetics now are doing is to essentially calculate what are called polygenic scores, which are measures of how many genes associated with ADHD that person has, very roughly, okay? Yeah. So with this sort of measure, you're able to say, okay, that person has got very high risk for ADHD or high liability for ADHD versus they have lower risk or liability for ADHD. And with that single sample of saliva, you can get that same measure for ADHD, but for anything else that has been studied in genetic studies. So you can look at risk for depression, for anxiety, genes that are associated with cognitive abilities, with educational attainment. So it really gives you, just with one single test, a huge amount of information about somebody's genetic makeup. Okay, so it's a very cost-effective type of test, but at present, it still has very little predictive power. So it has very limited ability to tell us whether somebody will or will not respond to a certain treatment. And that's something that is possibly going to change in the future. So genetic research is very fast moving, and they are identifying new genes associated with ADHD and other conditions every day. So it's likely that these polygenic scores will become a lot more powerful in the future, and then they could become more viable types of biomarkers for predicting treatment response or other types of outcomes. But it's probably a little bit behind still.
And I suppose the obvious question, and it may be straying outside of your really considerable reach in terms of as a researcher, but still, I'm going to try it. People will only ever get this stuff done mainly once. So you get an MRI done once. How does that overlap with the work looking at using these diagnostically to contribute towards a diagnosis of ADHD?
Yes, and it's that's also very interesting. So biomarkers of diagnosis is another huge area. And again, measures of EEG, MRI, and genetics as well have been investigated to figure out whether they can be useful for improving the accuracy of our diagnostic assessments, essentially. Mm-hmm. There has been probably less headway in that sense, not because there has been less research, but because the findings have been very, very mixed.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can look at EEG, you can look at MRI, genetics, that's kind of like general across this type of markers. And one reason that the field is thinking about is that there is just not one type of ADHD, of course. There is so much variability between all people with ADHD that it's very unlikely that you'll be able to identify one or even a set of biomarkers that will be confidently telling you that person has ADHD or that person has ADHD and is also autistic, or they have ADHD and they may in the future also have depression. So it's a much messier picture.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no one gene you're looking for.
No, I mean, that's my impression of all of these sort of biomarker work, is that the more you look, the messier it gets. And I think that's particularly, I think it excites me. EEG excites me partly because it is so easy to do, and it's so dynamic, and it's cheap, and you know, I think you could fairly easily build it into a workup for somebody with ADHD. But the MRI stuff, which people do get quite excited about, I've always been a bit skeptical of, because it's so murky. And I found, you know, I think somebody did a paper looking at the different areas of the brain that have been implicated in ADHD, and it's basically everywhere.
Yeah. And everywhere, all in different studies, the opposite to another.
Yeah.
And again, because of this huge variability in the population.
Yeah, excellent. Speaking of the population, how about our penultimate question?
Penultimate question. What does this mean for people with ADHD?
So for people with ADHD, I know it can sound like, you know, like using these tests and, you know, you need to get a brain scan to be able to tell whether you respond or not to a medication. And I know that not everyone in the community has been very enthusiastic about work on EEG. And I know the autistic community in particular have been against like the amount of funding that have gone into research for biomarkers with EEG or other types. So of course it's something that we need to be mindful of.
It is worth just emphasizing why people are against it, just so we can kind of...
I'm wondering about that.
I think the argument is often that a lot of this research is very focused on mechanisms. So we're looking at this brain marker and this brain activity to understand how... what's underlying ADHD? That is this region in the brain or this other region that in the brain that works differently. And so it explains why people with ADHD are more hyperactive or more inattentive. This is all well and good, but there is a lot of other research that could be a lot more clinically relevant and then actually be more likely in the short term to have an impact on people's life. So the kind of argument for wanting to use EEG or other biomarkers in a more clinically applied sense is that you kind of get the you know, the best of both. So you can kind of understand what underlies it and what's going on, but also you can use this information for very clinically relevant outcomes, such as asking whether somebody is going to respond or not to a medication. If they're going to be put on stimulants or non-stimulants. So in this sense, I feel like I'm hoping that the research in this direction, trying to understand clinical outcomes that are very salient for people and their families, will have an impact. And the impact will be what we were discussing earlier. So rather than having to wait around for months or years until you find the treatment that works for you, you are kind of like saving all this time. And from the outset, from the moment that you get a diagnosis, then your clinician will be able to tell you with a certain degree of confidence that this medication I'm giving you now is likely going to work for you, and you will see effects within, you know, 2-3 weeks or even less than that. And that's, you know, something that it's common across areas of medicine. You know, you do a blood test and then you will receive a certain treatment, and then your a pediatrician or your GP will be able to tell you, I'm giving you this prescription and you will feel better within a week. It doesn't always
often
work.
You don't. Because blood tests are not nearly as accurate or useful as we think that they are. And that just winds me up so much how much doctors love blood tests
let's just run some bloods and we'll figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, rather than just look at the patient. Anyway, that's just my particular soapbox. I'll step lightly off it. I mean, I get the critique of biological research in autism. I think it is fueled by a history of discriminatory attitudes, of course. And it is also that, you know, why are you looking into why we're like we are rather than helping us mm-hmm. live our lives. Yes. I get that, but I think it is a very different picture in ADHD. It's one of those areas where the two conditions actually diverge quite a yes. lot, because there is a treatment for the core symptoms of ADHD, which there is not in autism.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. these, you know, so, and what you're doing is basically, you know, how can we predict whether these treatments are going to work?
Yes.
So my prediction would be that you're not going to get that many ADHD people objecting once they understand your
what yeah, your hopefully this is a line of work that is well received. So yeah.
No, I
and it's, but you know, it's
got two votes from the ADHD community here.
Don't speak.
Yeah.
Okay, I think your research is fine.
And I can't vote because I'm not 18 yet.
Oh.
Oh, okay. But yeah, no, but you know, involving people with ADHD in these sort of decisions is so important. And it's something that, you know, we are trying to do a lot more in our research. In the, like over the summer, we've actually, with my group, run a project with like having like a series of meetings with neurodivergent young people to identify new priorities for our work. So yeah. kind of identifying what our next funding application should be looking at. And it's been such a, you know, fantastic experience. We've learned so much, and I hope it's been interesting and, you know, fun for these young people that worked with us as well. And yeah. and funding bodies are listening a lot more to you know, people with ADHD, autistic people with, you know, all sorts of mental health conditions, to really kind of try and follow what their priorities are, which I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, and this links in very well.
Seamlessly.
With our, well, we've just put in a seam now, which is kind of unfortunate. But with our final question, which is, what are you planning next? What's your next research question?
Yeah, so kind of like building on this study, more like community study that we run over the summer, we are now essentially looking to expand my group's research more in the direction of investigating why people with ADHD and neurodivergent people more generally increased risk for mental health problems over the course of adolescence and young adulthood in particular. So we are looking to do that using EEG measures again, kind of trying to figure out whether some of these EEG measures would be able to tell us whether somebody will or will not be at risk for developing depression in the future, for example, but also other types of measures that can be associated with these later outcomes, such as you know, information about their environment. Of course, for mental health outcomes, you know, where, you know, the environment in which somebody is, how much, you know, their social relationships, for example, the family connections are very important. So can we use all this information to then be able to tell whether somebody who is autistic or somebody with ADHD will be at greater risk for developing depression or anxiety down the line? And that's something that I'm very passionate about, and I think it's one direction where neurodivergent people are really pushing. So I have been involved in and I'm like mentioning this because it's such a fantastic charity initiative. Embracing Complexity is a coalition.
Oh yes, I know them really well.
Yeah, so I've been working with them for a few years, and I was part of a special interest group on neurodivergence and mental health outcomes, really to try and investigate, you know, create greater awareness of mental health problems in neurodivergent people, and you know, essentially get more interest in this, more research in this overlap, and involving people with ADHD and neurodivergent people in this is a very important part of it. So I hope that these research directions will be successful and useful.
Well, and we have a link to our own podcast here. Embracing Complexity still run by Other Georgia?
Yes, she's still kind of involved, but now there is another person. Her name is Agatha.
She's
the lead of the Embracing Complexity within Autistica. So
Other Georgia, whose surname I have forgotten.
Harper? Harper?
Georgia Harper is one of the first people we interviewed for what was our previous podcast, which is the kind of predecessor of this podcast, Extraordinary Brains.
Right.
So Georgia...
Was she the very
first? Wow.
She wasn't quite first. She was very early.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've known Georgia for a long time. She's absolutely amazing. So go and
she's fantastic. It's been great to work with them all.
So listeners, go and listen to Georgia Harper's interview, which is a couple of years old now, and also...
Yeah, while you're there, listen to everything we've ever made. But finish this one first.
All 25 episodes of Extraordinary Brains.
It's a big milestone for us, 25.
Well, we have 12 episodes of this now, so...
Oh, okay. We can drink in America now.
Okay.
Oh, no, that's 21.
What are you talking about? It's not the number of podcast episodes you produce which allows you to drink alcohol.
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay, fine.
That's what it means when it says on the wall of pubs, under 25.
Okay. Anyway, I think it's about time we wrap this up. So thank you so much. We hope to see you again sometime when you have another fascinating bit of work to do. Tess is now trying to
extract. Of the listener's business, okay?
They're trying to extract the last bit of biscuit.
I'm trying to get the last bit of tea out of my tea mug before I put it in the wash.
Okay, all right. So,
thank you so much for having me.
And the interview.
It's been a pleasure being on the podcast and chatting with you both. Thanks all for this great podcast that you're doing.
I will be looking
up the episode with George as well.
Yes, exactly. All right. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So that was Georgia. All that remains to say is to please do share the podcast if you want to. Tell people about, if you're enjoying it, if you find it useful.
If there's a positive looking button on your screen, you should press it.
Exactly. And if there is anything that you want us to talk about or do differently in the podcast, please do let us know. Contact us via ADHD UK, the charity that sponsors us basically and helps us out with some support. So other than that, we'll see you for our next episode, which is going to be a Q&A probably, and hopefully in a week or so. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.